Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. For reasons beyond our control, we are unable to connect with our planned guest for this hour, the columnist Ruben Navarrete. We're going to do our best to reschedule with him. Instead, for now, we will bring you an archive edition of the show featuring particle physicist Brian Cox. It originally aired August 12th. You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does the universe work? Is it possible to objectively measure our position in space or our movement through time? And how do the structure of space and time play into the force of gravity? My guest this afternoon is Brian Cox. He lectures on particle physics at the University of Manchester, and he is part of the research team using the Large Hadron Collider to recreate the conditions of the first milliseconds after the Big Bang brought our universe into existence. It's hard to believe he has any spare time, but he devotes what there is to translating particle physics into terms that make sense to non-scientists in hopes we will all develop a passion for understanding the mysteries of the universe. His new book, co-written with Jeff Forshaw, is called Why Does E Equal MC Squared and Why Should We Care? Brian, welcome to Think.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
If there's anything that sounds more challenging to me than your day job, it is trying to make all this make sense to those of us who don't share your expertise. You use a lot of analogies and metaphors in the book. Does that correspond to the way you first understood it, or did you have to find an entirely different way of thinking about what you now know in order to help everybody else get there?
I hope that the book is written in the way that I think about physics and these big questions. And really, I think it's just thinking carefully and taking small steps and making sure you understand, you know, each step as you take it. And so I hope what we did in the book was make it as simple as possible. I mean, we do try and actually derive this equation, E equals MC squared. And that means that from first principles, you take very small, hopefully understandable steps and you get there. And the reader would hopefully be able to end up writing down this equation and understand how Einstein got there. So I think that science is at its heart simple. And I think that anybody who's interested and would spend a little bit of time can really do it. And I found that. I mean, honestly, I wasn't a great mathematician at school. And people always say to me now, you know, you're a professor of physics, you must be fantastic, some kind of prodigy at mathematics, and it wasn't like that at all. In fact, I failed one of my first maths exams at high school. but because I was interested in the way the universe works, I just kept trying to go as slowly as I needed to and understand the little steps. And I honestly think that's all there is to science.
Well, and in many ways here, Brian, the first step is the greatest in that it's sort of a leap of faith for many of us. We have to get away from what we think we understand as common sense in terms of space and time.
Yeah, that was Einstein's genius, actually. I mean, Galileo, so back in the 1500s, actually understood that picturing space as a box. I mean, and this is how we all picture it, I think, as a stage in which things happen. You know, so there's a real thing of space, and you can walk, you know, 3 miles to the north and then 2 miles to the east, and you're moving around in space. That was shown by Galileo to be something that you don't need. So it's a concept that isn't required. And the way he got there, actually, was to imagine someone moving. I was going to say on a train. Obviously, there weren't any trains when Galileo was around. But imagine someone moving on a train. And imagine blacking out all the windows and sitting there and perhaps putting some headphones on so you can't hear anything. One of the basic foundations of physics is that you cannot do an experiment, anything at all, to tell you that you're moving. You know, and you kind of know that intuitively. If you sit on a train or a plane and you put a book down in front of you and you go to the front of the plane and move back again, the book's still where you left it. So your seat doesn't move. So you have no real sensation of moving. And what the genius of these physicists was to say, well, if I can't show that I'm moving, then motion must be an illusion, essentially. Relative is what you'd say if you were Einstein. So if you can't tell that you're moving, and from that they realize that means that space itself is kind of a redundant concept, because if you can't tell whether you're moving from one place to the other or not, then the idea of place itself is probably meaningless. And so that sounds a bit in a way, a bit zen-like, you know. But actually what happens when you take that seriously and you say, you do science then, you say, well, what are the consequences of assuming that? And you're led, eventually, to Einstein's theory of space and time. You end up demolishing both of those concepts and replacing them with a new concept that for all we can tell, appears to be true. So the ultimate test is whether you, from that reasoning, you get to something that you can test, that you can actually measure. And if you measure it and it's wrong, then your theory is wrong and you go back to the drawing board again. And E equals MC squared comes from that kind of reasoning, and it's something you can measure. It's the way the sun works. It's the way that nuclear power stations work. And it turns out to be, as far as we can tell, the correct picture of the universe.
Well, let's remind people who haven't been in a classroom and studied this for a while. Yes. E equals MC squared, the actual formula means energy equals mass times the speed of light squared.
Yeah, which is the reason I wrote the book, actually, is that my wife, who is not a scientist, just said to me one day, you know, energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. So I can kind of see you're saying that energy equals mass. So what that's saying is that you can take some mass and make it into energy, and you can take some energy and make it into mass. And that's what happens when you burn anything, when you burn coal, actually. You burn a piece of coal, and you collect everything up that's left over when you've burnt it. It'll weigh a little bit less than it did before you started. So it really is, when you burn coal, you're converting a tiny, tiny bit of mass into quite a lot of energy. So she could understand that you can kind of buy that. But the speed of light squared. Now, what has the speed of light got to do with it? See, it functions as the exchange rate in that equation. It's E equals M, and then an exchange rate, like dollars to pounds. And why the speed of light would be there, it's a great question. And I didn't have a very simple answer. So I asked my friend Jeff Forshaw, who I work with on academic papers at Manchester. He's a theoretical physicist. And he didn't have a simple answer either. So we set ourselves the challenge of writing a book that actually my wife could understand, who is a non-scientist, just interested, that would really explain that. Not, you know, there are a lot of books about relativity that kind of dance around and just tell you things. And what we wanted to do was write a book that an interested reader could actually follow and without skipping anything, and would actually get to the point where they said, right, I understand why the speed of light's there. I mean, I could give you a kind of a... The correct but perhaps not enlightening answer is it's to do with the structure of space and time itself. So what Einstein did was really write down a theory of space and time and how they mesh together. And you could kind of see it. You know, distances in space you measure in meters, and distances in time, or the passage of time, you measure in seconds. Well, the speed of light is meters per second. It's or miles per second, or whatever you want to call it. It's the amount of distance light travels in a certain amount of time. And that's kind of where it comes in. It's when you mesh space and time together, you end up with this special speed, the speed of light, which plays a very key role in the theory, actually. It stops you building time machines to go into the past, for example. So it's a very important concept in the theory, and that's how it sneaks into E equals MC squared.
Well, Einstein obviously was building on a long legacy of scientific achievement, but he most graciously sort of tipped his hat to this guy, James Clerk Maxwell. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how Maxwell found his way to the speed of light?
Yes, it was fascinating, actually. Even before Maxwell, there were people like Faraday who were in London at the time doing experiments with electricity and magnetism. So they were essentially building electric motors, playing around with coils of wire. And they just carefully measured what happens. You know, if you put an electric current through a wire, then a compass needle gets deflected. So that was interesting to them because it suggested there was some connection between electricity, which was newly discovered at the time, and magnetism, which everybody knew from compasses, from navigating ships.
And there are two things that wouldn't seem to be related, at least before this time.
Well, yeah, so it was a real surprise to them. So that was the cutting edge of science in the 1830s, the 1840s. And then Maxwell came along, a Scottish physicist, in the 1860s, and wrote down, he looked at all the work that had been done and wrote down a set of equations. So like Newton's laws, you know, like if you, anyone who's done high school physics will remember F equals MA, you know, the famous Newton's law, even if they can't remember what it says. And then, so Maxwell's equations are the equivalent for electricity and magnetism. And what he found was this number kept cropping up in the equations. And it's actually the ratio of the strength of the electric force and the magnetic force. So it's a kind of a number that sneaks in, and it's always the same. So that ratio is always the same, no matter how you're moving around, no matter how you measure it, no matter where or when you measure it, it's a constant number. And it came in as a speed. And so Maxwell just discovered this kind of universally important speed. And also he discovered that it was the speed that light moves. So quite remarkably, from these little benchtop experiments with motors and wires and magnets, the speed of light entered into the equations just naturally. So that was a puzzle, because it was always the same. And that's a bit odd if you think about it, because if you overtake someone in a car, then if you overtake another car, then the kind of speed that you overtake them has something to do with how fast the cars are moving. You know, if you're moving at 60 miles an hour and the person you overtake is moving at 40 miles an hour, then you overtake them at 20 miles an hour. But this number didn't seem like that. It seemed like it was a universal number that everyone would always agree on, no matter how they were moving. And so that caused a lot of controversy in the 1860s. And people invented this idea of an ether, which is some sort of substance that permeates through space that light has to travel through. And this speed would be the speed of light in the ether. That's the same as the speed of sound. If you measure the speed of sound on Earth, it's the speed of sound in air. But Einstein's genius was to take these equations at face value and say, I believe Maxwell. I think that everything they did was correct. You don't need an ether for light to move around in. I believe that light moves in a vacuum. It just moves, and it always moves at this speed, and I'm going to work out the consequences of that. So both of them were very bold. Maxwell was bold and clever for getting it right and seeing there was a connection between electricity and magnetism and light. And then Einstein was bold in taking that at face value and believing it and saying, what are the consequences?
Yeah, and well into the 20th century, beyond the time that Einstein was actively working, people were still looking for ether.
Well, yes, at the turn of the century, because it makes sense. I mean, if you think about it, a water wave needs some water. You know, a sound wave needs air. You know, there's that famous thing from the James Cameron's film Alien. Not James Cameron's, it's Ridley Scott, isn't it? In space, no one can hear you scream.
Right.
You know, so you would think that an influence needs something to move through, because everything that everyone knew at the time did. And this is, I think, one of the keys to science. As you mentioned earlier, it's suspending your common sense when there's really nothing else to do, and realizing that our common sense is not necessarily a guide to the way the universe works. And it's scattered all the way through science. You know, it is surprising that, you know, at the moment we think the universe is 13.7 billion years old and the Earth is 4.8 billion years old. These huge numbers. These numbers don't come easily to people. You know, they shouldn't. The universe behaves in a way that's sometimes surprising and shocking. And the only way you can, I think, understand that is to understand that our perception, as we look out now, as you look out in your room, you're looking at your perception is tuned to the environment that you see. I mean, we've, you know, in a sense evolved to understand this environment. So when you start talking about things that are moving at 186,000 miles a second, which is the speed of light, or for that matter, you look at atoms and molecules which behave, you know, quantum mechanics is this rather strange theory of small things, then our intuition fails, and perhaps that shouldn't be surprising.
And nothing can go faster than the speed of light?
No, I mean, it comes into Einstein's theory as a universal speed limit, in fact. And in fact, the speed of light itself is a bit of a red herring. What Einstein discovered was that it's actually the speed of things that have no mass. So basically, the reason light travels at the speed of light is because it doesn't have any mass. And I guess we could come to that a bit more after the music.
We will, absolutely. Yeah. Brian Cox is my guest. He's a professor of particle physics at the University of Manchester. His new book is called Why Does E Equal MC Squared and Why Should We Care?
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is Brian Cox. He's professor of particle physics at the University of Manchester. He is also working on the Large Hadron Collider that straddles the border between France and Switzerland, trying to find the origins of the universe. So you left us with a sort of a cliffhanger, a physics cliffhanger. You were saying that the speed of light is not really so much the issue here. It's anything that has no mass.
Yes, and this actually links to what we're doing at the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, because we're trying to understand what mass is. Because very interestingly, Einstein, although he got the equation right, as far as we can tell, he didn't really know what mass was. It was just a property that things have. And to this day, we don't. And it's one of the main reasons we built the LHC at CERN. So what Einstein found was that you can have things that have no mass, particles that have no mass, which is a very strange idea if you think about it, because you think of an electron or a proton, you know, the things that make up our bodies. You think if you're going to be a particle, a subatomic particle, then you must have substance. In fact, Einstein found that you can have particles that have no mass, but they must travel at the speed of light. And conversely, anything that has any mass can't travel at the speed of light through space. And so that's what he found. So what we know is that photons, which are in particle physics language, are the particles of light. So my picture of light would be you're looking through the window now, then a stream of particles are coming along and going into your eyes, and that's how you detect the light, and that's a valid way of thinking about it. Those things have no mass, and we don't know why. We have an idea, it's this thing called the Higgs mechanism. So you often read about us looking for the Higgs particle or the Higgs boson, sometimes called the God particle. Well, that thing, in our theory, is responsible for giving some particles mass and leaving other particles alone. And it happens to leave photons alone, and so they travel at the speed of light. So perhaps that's one of the first steps in demystifying E=mc², because a lot of the first thing you think is, what has the speed of light got to do with energy and mass? Well, it turns out that it's not really the speed of light, it's the speed of things that haven't got any mass. So perhaps you can begin to see how it can get its way into that equation.
We haven't talked very much yet about time. What makes E=mc² a description of space and time?
Well, in just the same way that this notion of space as an arena was removed, and so you end up getting rid of absolute space. If you combine that with Maxwell, who had this special speed, this that never changes, this speed measuring in miles per hour, let's say, on miles per second, the speed of light, then perhaps you can see that if you say that miles are a kind of a redundant concept, and because distances between things can change and don't really matter and depend on who's looking at them, then if you're going to keep a speed the same, then you might want to look at time as well, because speeds are measured in distance divided by time, right? Meters divided by seconds. What Einstein found was the only way you could build a consistent theory, so a picture of space and time that allowed you to have this special speed, the speed of light, then you had to allow time also to become subjective. So really what Einstein says is that your time that you measure on your watch is unique to you. Right? You always understand what you mean by 1 second and 2 seconds and 3 seconds. But somebody else in a different place, moving past you on a train or standing on a different planet or with a different, particularly with a different gravitational pull on them, actually, has no reason and there's no need for them to measure time in the same way that you do. And indeed, they don't. And the best example I can think of, actually, is the global positioning system. So, you know, satellite navigation in your car. That relies on measuring time differences between the ground, clocks on the ground, and clocks on satellites, which are in orbit, so high above the Earth, think about 7,000 miles above the Earth's surface. And Einstein predicted, unbelievably, in 1905 and 1915, that time would pass at a different rate in orbit, away from the Earth, than it would on the ground. And it turns out that if you didn't correct for that, Einstein got it right, if you didn't correct for it, then the GPS system would drift by 35,000 feet a day. Right, so that means your position in your car would go wrong by miles every day, and so you have to correct for it. And I find it amazing, actually, that someone working in the Swiss Patent Office in 1905 could write down the equations that would be needed to run the satellite navigation system that we have today. But that's, in a way, the beauty of physics.
So we know that the time can be experienced differently depending on where you are and how fast you're moving. Why is it, though, that it only moves in one direction?
Well, the answer to that is, in Einstein's theory, because no one can travel faster than light. See, what Einstein did was that he made time another dimension. So we often hear about this, that it's something about four dimensions, and you hear it a lot. It's one of the reasons we wrote the book, actually, to explain that. But if you think about it, that leaves an interesting possibility, because in space, you're allowed to move wherever you want. So you're allowed to go from your house and walk down to the beach and then walk back to your house again. You have completely free movement in these three dimensions of space. So if you just stick time in there and say, well, that's a fourth dimension, then it would seem that you would have free movement through time as well. So you could go backwards in it, just as you can go to the beach and come back to your house. What stops you going into the future and then walking back into the past again? Because it really is built like that, Einstein's theory. Well, it turns out that this speed of light, this special speed, plays a really key role in preventing you from having free movement in time. And actually, you're confined to head into your future. The interesting limit of that, as it were, is if you're a photon, if you're a massless thing and you're traveling at the speed of light through space, it then turns out that you do not travel through time at all. So for a photon, no time passes. So in a very real sense, the photons that enter your eye from a distant galaxy, let's say the Andromeda Galaxy, which is 2.2 million light years away, our nearest galactic neighbor, which means it takes light, from our perspective, 2.2 million years, traveling at 186,000 miles a second to journey from the nearest galaxy to our eye. From the photon's point of view, from the light's point of view, it takes no time at all. It just happens in an instant. And so that's really the... I mean, when I say these things sometimes, I think, well, it sounds just like Zen nonsense, you know. But this is why we wrote the book, because I do believe that whilst it's difficult to explain it in 5 minutes, I believe that it can be explained to anyone who's interested, but in a book and not in a five-minute conversation. So, but that's the heart of it, is that one way of thinking about it is that, interestingly, and this is going to sound Zen-like as well, everything travels at the speed of light through space-time. So this is quite a deep insight in Einstein's theory. So we now, you and me, we sat still in space, as far as we're concerned, and Einstein would say we're flying through time at the speed of light. And then if someone moves relative to us, then they're still flying through space and time at the speed of light. But they're using a bit of their speed of light, to move through space. And so their speed through time slows down a bit. And that's indeed what we measure with the satellite navigation system. If you move a little bit, then your watch runs a little bit slower than the person who's standing still. And that's one of the nice explanations you can have. Einstein's theory forces you to move through space-time at the speed of light, bizarrely. But... So the corollary, so I don't confuse everyone completely, is that you're prevented from going through space at the speed of light for using all your speed to go through space unless you've got no mass. So that's kind of how it interweaves together. And it's quite a nice geometric picture, actually, which I hope we explain in the book.
Brian Cox is my guest. The book is called Why Does E Equal MC Squared and Why Should We Care? Let's take a call now. We'll speak with Brian in Fort Worth. Hello, Brian.
Hi, Chris. Yes, I would like to ask Dr. Cox a question about the Hadron Collider, change topics just a little bit.
Yeah.
As I understand it, the collider, one of the functions or possibilities of things it might determine is whether or not the Higgs boson particle exists and whether or not you guys or the scientific community can prove that it exists. And of course, that, I believe, is a subatomic particle itself that is theorized to hold all other subatomic particles together, thus all mass together. If you do discover it, is there a chance that there are subparticles to it in of itself, and there's really no end to our quest for finding smaller and smaller particles?
Yeah, it's a great question, and yes, I mean what this Higgs thing does, as you said, is give mass to other things. So that the picture is that we are in a sense swimming in a sea of Higgs particles now, and the reason that the particles that make up my hand, for example, have mass is because they're interacting with them. It's almost like dragging your hand through a big vat of maple syrup, right? And there's some resistance. So as you pull your hand through it, it feels heavier in some sense. And the Higgs basically works like that. But that's just a specific job. And it's the reason we're asking this question is because since the 1960s, actually, we've had a theory, just like Newton's laws, again, that you can write down for the way that all the particles of nature that we know of interact with all the others. So electricity and magnetism is built into that theory. The nuclear forces that stick the nucleus together are built into that theory. Gravity, interestingly, isn't in that theory, but that's a different issue. And what happens when you try and stick all the forces of nature together and all the particles together is you get a problem with mass. Just in the way the theory works. And so this Higgs mechanism was introduced to deal with that. And we've been stuck there since the 1960s. Now, the LHC at CERN will definitely either discover the Higgs or discover whatever mechanism it is, because nature may have been cleverer than us, but whatever mechanism it is that generates mass. And that's really like a door in our understanding of the universe that's been closed to us. It's a sticking point, and we need to get past it. But there's nothing at all in the theory that says that there's not a huge amount of physics, a huge amount of understanding beyond that. It's certainly not the end of our understanding of the universe. It's the next step that we need to get across. So it's a very exciting time, actually, to be a physicist.
We have an email here from Cal who asks if you would explain why photons are influenced by gravity when they have no mass.
Well, I mean, one way of looking at it is to look at E equals MC squared. So if you say that you need mass to be influenced by gravity, so the picture is that the Earth, for example, is a very massive thing, and so it has a gravitational field. Well, if energy and mass are essentially the same thing, and in Einstein's theory they are, then there's no reason why energy can't function in the same way. And it does in Einstein's theory of gravity. So if you've got energy, you respond to gravity in the same way that you've, as if you had mass. There's really no difference in Einstein's theory between the two. And conversely, energy on its own can create gravity, as it were. So it's in E equals MC squared. There's no difference between the two.
Let's go next to Jan in Dallas. Hi, Jan.
Oh, hello. My question is this. When we think in terms of, or when lay people think in terms of quantum physics, we think in terms typically of size, smaller and smaller and smaller. And when we think in terms of cosmology, often we think in terms of space or farther and farther, at least the layperson does. But what is the science on what studies are being done in the infinitely large? And how does that fit in science? Does it fit into quantum physics, or does it even exist, or cosmology?
You know, it's a really great question, because this is the big problem in fundamental physics at the moment. It's how to... I just mentioned in the last answer, actually, that gravity doesn't live in our theory of the rest of the universe. So our theories of particle physics, which are theories of all the forces of nature apart from gravity, they're quantum theories. And gravity, our best description, is Einstein's from 1915. It's certainly not a quantum theory. And so many physicists are working on how you would bring those together into a single framework. So as you said, gravity is really a force that we think of as existing between planets and between galaxies on the biggest possible distances. And then all the other stuff is the tiny stuff, on subatomic level. And the answer is we don't know. You may have heard of string theory, which is an attempt to do this. It doesn't work particularly well at the moment, but it's an attempt to try and do that. It's a very difficult problem. Einstein worked on it from 1915 pretty much to his death in the 1950s and didn't come to an answer. So it's one of the biggest questions in physics, and we don't know. There's a possibility the LHC might give us some signposts, but it's a long shot. and we really don't know how to do it. There's one interesting thing we've observed, which may be a crossover between the small and the large, and that's that recently we found that the universe is accelerating in its expansion. It's very difficult to understand. The picture of the universe is beginning at the Big Bang, everything flying away from everything else, and then gravity, because it's an attractive force, you can picture it slowing everything down, perhaps even stopping it and making it all recollapse to a crunch again. Well, we found that that's not true, and there's something, we call it dark energy, because we don't know what it is, which seems to be pushing all the galaxies away from each other faster and faster. And there's some sense in which that's predicted in quantum mechanics, in the world of the small. So although it goes horribly wrong when you look at the details, so we really don't understand it. But there are hints like that there's a link between the world of the subatomic particles and the world of gravity and the world of the way the cosmos works on the large scale. But it's right at the cutting edge, and we don't really understand it, which makes it fascinating.
What do we know right now about the shape of the universe and how it might or might not relate to the mass contained within it?
Oh, we know that there is not enough mass in the universe to cause it to recollapse. So I mentioned this kind of big crunch idea. If there was enough stuff in the universe, then gravity alone would slow everything down and make it all start flying back together again. Now, we know that there's certainly, well, as far as we can tell, there's not enough stuff in the universe to do that. But still, the universe should, in that simple picture, continue to expand but slow down a bit and continue slowing down. But as I mentioned, in the last 10 years or so, we've had this strange observation that everything's flying apart faster and faster. And honestly, we don't understand why that is.
Brian Cox is with us. He's professor of particle physics at the University of Manchester. His new book is called Why Does E Equal MC Squared and Why Should We Care?
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
Listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Brian Cox, whose new book is called Why Does E Equal MC Squared and Why Should We Care? Can you talk for a minute, Brian, about the way that distance is affected between two physical objects when something approaches the speed of light?
Yeah, this is if you have a theory where space has really no meaning. So as we mentioned right at the start, it's not an arena. You have to stop thinking of it as an arena within which things happen. Then there's no reason really why the distance between things, which you would picture as, you know, if something's a mile away, you would picture that you had to walk a mile in space to get to it. Well, once you get rid of this notion of absolute space, then there's no reason why that distance should be the same for everybody. And indeed, in Einstein's theory, it isn't. And so in a very particular way, these distances change. So if something moves, imagine there's something that's a foot long that's flying past you very close to the speed of light, and you watch it, then you see it shrink. So it really looks to you that it's less than a foot, and in fact it can shrink and shrink and shrink and shrink. And there's an example in the book actually where we work out how, I can't remember the exact numbers that we use, but we say if you've got a garage that's let's say 20 foot long, how fast would you have to drive a 25 foot long car to fit it into the garage? You know, because if you sit there and watch, then the car will come speeding along and it will be it will shrink. It will look like it shrinks. And there is actually a speed you could drive it at to just about fit it into the garage. Of course, it would then fly through the back wall and make a mess. But that's a real effect. And again, it's linked to this. The best example I can give is that the global positioning system, the satellite navigation, works, and it needs these principles. The fact that time runs slower and distances get shrunk as you move fast, it's It's I know it's a strange sounding theory, but I think that's why it's fascinating. Because it's worth saying, actually, there's the why should we care bit in the title. And it turns out that much of the stuff we take for granted today is based on Einstein's theory, the so-called relativistic theories. So, for example, the way that silicon chips work in you know, everything, computers, mobile phones, TVs, that understanding requires you to understand relativity. It really is the foundation on which 20th century science and technology is built. So whilst it sounds odd, you need it to build a cell phone.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Nick in Dallas. Hello, Nick.
Hello. My name's Nick from Dallas. Brian, I have a question that relating to E equals MC squared.
Yeah.
If I look at a dimensional analysis and say that C is length over time,
yep.
So C squared is length squared over time squared,
yep.
Both of those are dimensions in space and time. So does that make it a dimensionless quantity, and therefore that E is a constant times mass?
Let me think of the best way of answering that. Basically, the reason that you've got this speed in there, this C squared, is because of the way you measure energy and mass. Right now, as a particle physicist, what we tend to do is measure energy and mass in the same units, right? We call them electron volts. So, the speed of light is the fact there's a speed there comes in depending on how you measure energy and mass. I mean, remember that energy and mass are quantities that the Victorians knew about. You know, that if you want to build a bridge, you need to know about these things. So, it certainly worked. These concepts of having energy and how much things weigh and things like that worked in the before Einstein. So you're right in a way. It's a bit of a complicated answer, isn't it? In the book, we do go into this actually, the function of the speed of light and how it behaves. But you're right in the sense in the question that you ask. It's a bit complicated for the radio, though, isn't it?
Can light travel beyond the universe? Can it exist?
No. I mean the picture that we have of the way the universe began and evolved is that space and time began at that point, right? So the modern physicist view is that before the Big Bang is not even a question you can ask for a start, because time began at that point. So there's no sense in saying what's beyond space and time, because it's you know space. You need space to have a concept of beyond, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But it's a big question. It's an open question as to how the universe began. Well, the answer is we don't know. We know that something interesting happened 13.7 billion years ago, and that's quite. It's easy to see how we know that, because we look at everything in the sky. Everything's flying away faster and faster. You can measure how fast everything's flying away from each other, and you essentially run the film back, run the tape back, and you can see everything go back to a point. So you know something interesting happened, The simple theory is that space and time began at that point. So there's no concept of before the Big Bang or beyond space and time, beyond the universe. But that's an interesting area, because it's a great question. You know, it's a question everybody asks. You know, why did the universe begin? And it's not very satisfactory to say, well, you're not allowed to say what happened before the Big Bang because there was no time. You know, it sounds like a bit of a dodge, doesn't it? So people ask that question and think about it. But we don't have a framework, really, to talk about that at the moment in science.
Let's go next to Frisco, where we'll speak with George. Hi, George.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
My question of Dr. Cox is, has the speed of light ever been measured? And if so, how?
Yes, it is measured. And let me think, the first way it was measured, I think it was with mirrors on mountaintops. Now, I can't remember exactly, but it was a beautiful measurement. I'm sure it was, actually, but I can't remember the year in which it was measured. But it's not that fast, I mean, in a way. I mean, it's quite easy. I mean, for example, it travels 1 foot in 1,000 millionth of a second, right? So that sounds like a lot, but a small amount of time. But 1,000 millionth of a second, the so-called nanosecond, is a very long time in a computer, for example. I mean, computers work that fast. And so it's not only a kind of esoteric measurement. It's not like, well, it's so fast that we don't care about it. That movement of the in wires, for example, of electric current in wires, are signals in optical fibers, is something you have to take into account when you design fast computers. For example, my experiment at CERN, we have collisions that occur every, I can't remember the number actually, but it's so fast that you get loads of signals in these wires just separated by a few feet. And so you need to take into account the slowness of the speed of light, as it were, in the design of your electronics. And so it sounds like a very, again, an esoteric thing, the speed of light, but it matters in just simply designing computers.
Let's go next to Patrick in Richardson. Hi, Patrick.
Hello. I would like to ask the question. I went to a seminar once at the Aspen Institute, and there were a lot of people there from CERN or the other one in Chicago, the other supercollider.
Tevatron.
And, you know, I know that you know this is the case, and it's not nefarious in any way, shape, and form, but just the instrumentation that's used to analyze the collisions and the particles and the ingredients that are formed after a collision, those sensors are also like easily just flipped around and developed for like measurement intelligence as well. And at the forefront of physics, you talking about the theory of relativity, you know, you're very familiar with the theory of relativity. And, you know, when the theory of relativity was postulated, it was brand new. If you could think in the future of like combining aspects of quantum cryptography, combining aspects of, you know, out-of-the-box thinking like the Professor Malik from Harvard on how he spins up just air using lasers that are at right angles, to once you start anything in motion, then Einstein's theory of relativity starts to come into effect once motion is put into play. And in the next 20 years, it's going to be you and your colleagues that are going to, like, push the envelope again, combining all these aspects of stuff that make almost little or no sense to us.
Well, yeah, it's a good point. I mean, one of the... I think you're talking about the technology we use, because particle physics is very difficult. By the way, I just remembered from the last caller, it's every 25 nanoseconds is our collision rate. Huh. So that means that the signals go 25 feet before the next collision comes along in our wires. So that's why it matters a lot. It's very slow. But to your question, one of the great spin-offs from particle physics has been medical imaging, for example. So PET scans, if you go to hospital and have a PET scan, that's called positron emission tomography, right? So positrons are antimatter electrons. So all this rather esoteric stuff that we did, we discovered antimatter, we learned how to contain it and use it, we learned how to detect it. That's used in medical imaging. So some of the great spin-offs from particle physics have been in the medical industry. Now, as you say, there may be spin-offs in communications. You never really know. What I think is very important about science like this, in the same way that going to the moon is important or exploring the solar system is important, is that when you overreach, when you stretch the technology to its limit to try and work out how the universe works, it usually turns out to be incredibly useful for reasons that you could not imagine. And I think that's kind of an obvious statement. Understanding the universe is an important thing to do for us, right? But you often hear people say, well, what's the use? You know, why should we spend tax dollars on finding the Higgs particle? Well, that's not really the point. The point is that history teaches you that when you explore and when you push technology to the limit, you learn things that become useful in ways you would never imagine. And it's obvious that would be the case. So... I think these technologies that we develop are astonishing, turn out usually to be astonishingly useful for other reasons.
Well, let's go next on the phone to Doyle in Fort Worth. Hi, Doyle.
Hello. Professor Cox, I appreciate your shows on cable TV, and I have a question about time. And did time exist before the Big Bang?
Well, yeah, I mean, we just spoke a little bit about that, actually. The answer, the standard answer is no. Space and time began at the Big Bang. However, there are theories. There's a colleague of mine, Neil Turek, who's also written a good book, actually, that you can find on Amazon, about he's a cosmologist, and he's looking at ways of imagining the universe has been around forever, and then just something happened in that universe that caused the thing we see as the Big Bang. And it is true that all we know is that something interesting happened 13.7 billion years ago. I mean, we're absolutely sure about that. But what that thing was is basically based on theory. So you can speculate that actually the universe was around forever, which many people find more natural. I mean, then you don't have to bother about how it began. It's just been around forever. You know, and there are serious theorists who look at these theories. So it's a good question, and there is no definitive answer at the moment, which is the joy of science.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the work environment at the Large Hadron Collider in particular. Obviously, this really vibrant community of scientists, and in a lot of ways, it's a very creative place in a way that might take people by surprise.
Oh, it really is. I mean, one of the best examples I can give is the invention of the World Wide Web, which is obviously transformed the way that we live today. That was done by a guy called Tim Berners-Lee, who worked at CERN, and he's said many times on record that he wouldn't have been able to do it anywhere else because he was given the freedom to explore. And there's a wonderful his proposal is, you can see it on the web actually. He wrote a proposal down to his manager at CERN and said, "I've got this idea for this hypertext transfer protocol (HTTP)," and his manager wrote on it in pen, vague but interesting, right, and gave it back. But he said, because this is the way that CERN works, well, you go away and carry on. I don't get it. It's vague, but it's interesting. Go on. And then, you know, a year later, he'd built the world's first web browser, and it's contributed trillions of dollars to the world economy. You know, and this is the great thing about CERN. It's like a world university. There are over 85 countries working there. It's a free environment, and you're encouraged to think out of the box. So whilst we're doing particle physics there, these spin-offs happen because of the wonderful environment there is.
Brian Cox's new book, co-written with Jeff Forshaw, is called Why Does E Equal MC Squared and Why Should We Care? Brian, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.